Accession number 22584, Rule 2.
Jim Hogg, Rule 2.
Right. We had Christmas at Sunderland, and this was illustrative of the attitude the people had. I was fortunate in that I had relatives who lived outside Sunderland, the mining areas, so that I knew what I would be doing for my Christmas day. In addition, I'd already associated with the chapel in Sunderland and had got to know quite a few people there. But I do remember vividly that I was in the billet, and a lady came and asked me, she said, "Have you any of your men who haven't anywhere to go at Christmas?" And there was not one that had not got somewhere to go, that had been invited to spend Christmas with a person. In fact, there were several of us had to make a choice in a way. But I thought that was really demonstrative of the attitude of the people in the Northeast. Very friendly, very friendly. After Sunderland, we remained in the Northeast, and our training was with most of the people who were based in the Northeast, so that we had exercises to undergo. We moved down to West Hartlepool, and then we moved on to the North York Moors. But we were based at could have told you. Stokesley was the main town in the area. Scutterskelf Hall, I recollect, was used by headquarters, you see, officers. And now then, there were so many little villages like Coxwold, nestling in the North York Moors. But there was one, I'll have to come back to that one. In this village anyway, it was a large village, we were well received again. And it was there that I was able to attend the chapel and take services in the village chapel. Our colonel was Colonel E.B. Robinson, who was a bit of a Tartar. Never knew which way to take him. He always expected you to either stand, salute, or sit up straight, or whatever, acknowledge his presence in some way. And he was known, but we never went abroad with him because he was too old. He'd been brought back anyway to look after us. But he was our colonel all this time, and I got to know him pretty well with being attached to the vehicles. In fact, whilst we were at this village, his name will come eventually, we took from the manufacturers a Humber vehicle, a car, for the commanding officer. And I, at that time, was again, as I say, looking after some of the technical side, and I took receipt of this vehicle that a civilian brought from somewhere in the Midlands, I suppose. And I was able to tell the colonel that his car had arrived. He was delighted with the car. Yes, it was quite a nice Humber. Typical, the sort of thing that they have on display at the Beverley Museum at the moment, you know. And so I did get to know him from that part of the North York Moors. We then went to Middlesbrough. Now this takes us to the end of 1941, because it was then that they decided that the 8th Battalion, East Yorks, should become a light ACAC battery, regiment. So we became the 115 Light Attack Regiment, RA. That was the, so we ceased to be an infantry battalion on the 31st of December 1941. Again, the people in Middlesbrough were very much like the people in Sunderland. They were very kind and hospitable. And there were occasions, of course, I was caught in those days, and my girlfriend came up and stayed with folks as I'd got to know for a weekend. She was working at Smith and Nephews, actually. That's what she was working. Well, she worked right through the war at Smith and Nephews. She was not called up because it was classed as a reserved occupation. They were making bandages and packs like that for dressings, field dressings. Anyway, it was very nice that you could invite your girlfriend up to stay. This happened to me in Hartlepool and in Middlesbrough. And then in the January of 42, we were then trained as ACAC gunners. Now, by this time, because of what I was doing with the vehicles, I became MT sergeant. I was technical sergeant, so that I was responsible that all these vehicles had what was required. It wasn't necessary. I wasn't REME. We had a REME man, actually, but this was some post that was just specific to infantry battalions. So that if a vehicle required a part, broke down, then it was my job to find that part somewhere. So that some of the vehicles that we had to commandeer in 1940, a butcher's van from Brightlingsea and Carlside Cooperative at Sheffield, with a ventilator thing on the top. Just like, I always remember it here because it's Dad's army, really. Because, believe it or not, two of the lads decided to go on leave without permission, and they took that vehicle to go in. So the military police and everybody else were on the lookout for this particular vehicle. Same vehicle actually broke an axle. It was a Dennis was the engine. And the only place where we could get a replacement was Glasgow. But that was my job to see if I could get a replacement axle for this vehicle. It was quite an interesting job. And some of the things that we'd actually commandeered, one of the vehicles, which was absolutely useless really, was a car belonging to the Marquis of Londonderry, who was based up in the northeast, and it was a Lagonda with huge headlights which you couldn't use, and it only had two seats, you know. It was a splendid vehicle, and there were various others that we got. But now, by 1942, we were making our own again, and we received then a vehicle which would carry the gun crew, which was 10 in number, so we had 10 in the gun crew. You got the sergeant and the driver and the cook, who was also a member of the crew. I mean, he had the task to do apart from cooking. But we were very, very fortunate. We had a chap called Armitage who was very good at cooking. But we received this Bedford vehicle which towed the gun, which was a Bofa, a 40mm Bofa. And we spent the next year, 1942, training and moving about so that the beginning of 1942, after we'd been basically trained in Chester, a place called Satan Camp, which I believe is still a military setup, we finished up at Dover and Margaret, St. Margaret's Bay and Deal. And I recollect having a gun on the cliffs there. But of course, behind us were the long-range guns that used to come out and fire a few shells across the channel. I never saw them fired, but they used to bring them out quite frequently. On, you know, they were on rails, and they used to move these huge things out. And you'd see them and wonder if they were going to fire, and then the barrel came down and shunted them back into their whatever it was, a cave, cavern of some sort.
Were you getting any incoming shells from the Germans?
No. No, we weren't. There were, of course, but not actually where we were. We were fortunate. And then from there we moved to Shorncliffe Barracks at Folkestone.
Was your unit in action against German planes?
No. We were there. I remember one occasion in about September. We were in Ashford, Kent, and a German plane came across. And I saw it, and so did one or two others. And we had a gun crew out, and they were there on the gun. But nobody fired. And it was unmistakably a German. I forget now what model it was. Anyway, that was the one occasion when perhaps that gun should have fired. But there was nobody there who shouted fire. By the time... Well, I ran out. By the time I got there, they played a gun across. And on reflection, I wondered perhaps, well, if we'd had a go and we'd hit it, it would have come down on Ashford and perhaps done far more damage than if we let it go. Anyway, it went. So that was about it. But we were never in action in this country at all. Then, the end of 42... we were designated to go to North Africa on the torch landings. And that's when we got to Tunisia.
What was the process of getting to North Africa?
We were at Aldershot when the King came to inspect troops going abroad. And when that happened, you knew you'd been called. The King inspected the regiment. We left Aldershot and went to Liverpool, and we sailed from Liverpool on Christmas Eve, 1942. Christmas Eve. We were on an old troop ship, belonged to the Bibby Line. It was called the Derbyshire. I believe it was replaced by another boat years later called the Derbyshire. That's what it was. It was actually, didn't know this at the time, but we were just one brigade of the 46th Division, 139 Brigade. We'd been selected to go first, I don't know why. All I know is that on this ship there were something like 5,000 troops. We were in a convoy, of which we were the slowest vessel. Flat out, I believe, we could do 17 knots. So we were escorted by destroyers. But the whole business was that we got to move quickly, as fast as we could. And so it was a bit of a hazard, not appreciated at the time, actually. We were too busy trying to settle down to life on board ship. We were fortunate in that we, as ACAC, were allocated to defence of the ship, so that we had to do duties, you know, as required, on the guns that were already there for ACAC defence. And that meant that in turn, I as a sergeant, together with my crew, would do a four-hour stint on A deck, which was very nice, because it was a bit rough for those on the decks below, as many were. So I spent, and this was in January, I always remember that when I was on duty, the warmest place was a bench just near the base of the funnel. It was a very nice place to stretch. And I always recollect it was the 31st of December, and I was on duty, and it was, middle of the morning, so that it was just coming down to New Year's Day, as it were. It would be January the 1st, because it was during the night. And I was walking round, and I went into the bridge section, you know, where the cocks were. And I said, "Where are we then?" So he said, "We're just off Cape Finisterre." "Oh, 1,000 miles, mind you." Well into the Atlantic, 1,000 miles off Cape Finisterre, which is just off Spain. And then at the appropriate moment, we turned to go into the Med. And of course, this even became more hazardous. We were very fortunate that there were U-boats about, but we missed them. The slower convoy that came later with equipment and together with nurses and staff for the medical side of it, at least two of those vessels were sunk in the Mediterranean. Well, we were fortunate that we made it to Algiers. And then a new life started altogether for me and all the rest of us, I suppose. We'd spent 3 weeks. Well, how long would it be? December the 25th, 7 days. I should think we spent about 14 days, during which time, of course, we had to go around in sandshoes in order to stop any noise with heavy boots tramping. And when we got to Algiers, we of course had to get boots on again, and we were marched from there to a place, I have no idea what it was called, but I recollect this very clearly, because we disembarked on the docks at Algiers. We assembled. Now this is one battery of the regiment, you see, that's associated with 139 Brigade. It was just the one battery of 11. It was 379 lighter battery of 115 Regiment. And our major was a Beverley man. He'd been in the Territorials and as a captain, and he was called up, of course, in 1939, and he was at the barracks. And I was with him all the time, even in the barracks, you know, in 1939, 1940. And he was an insurance he had an insurance business. I'll give you his name in a minute. It's like that village that's disappeared into the past. Anyway, we'll carry on. That we set off from the docks, and we had a guide who was going to take us to where we were going to spend the next few days, waiting for our equipment so we could then move off on a long journey from Algiers into Tunisia. We're talking about 400 miles or so. Anyway, this chap sets off, and we'd had sandshoes on, so people were beginning to feel their feet somewhat. I mean, marched along. And then it got dark. And I know I was up at the front of the column, the major was saying, "Well, whereabouts are we going then?" Well, he said, "I've only been to this place once, and that was in the daytime." I thought, oh dear, typical army this. He doesn't really know where we're going, but we got there, and it was an orange grove, and it was a farm and a cluster of houses. And I think we landed there about something like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. As far as I could work out, we must have walked about 15 miles from Algiers. And all I remember about it is a place that was just on the outskirts of Algiers, because the name was there, and it, Maison Carrie. But after that, I couldn't give you any names at all. Not at all. When the equipment came, we were allowed trips to Algiers. That was a bit of a flavour. We saw what it was like in a North African town, and the Casbah and all the other attractions that there were. And then when the equipment came, the lorries, the guns, we then set off this long journey through, I always remember a place, Constantinople. Not the one on the isthmus. I don't think it was Opel, I think it was just Constantine or something like that in North Africa, which was French. Very much that part of the world was French. And we eventually came into the area that was the battlefield for the next 6 months. So we were up there about the middle of January.
What was the area of the battlefield?
This was North Tunisia. We were allocated the area that on the main road from Sejnane. Unfortunately, this chap here has got all these names down. Sejnane, that went through a place called Matur, M-A-T-E-U-R, to Bizerta, which was the part on the northern coast of Tunisia. And that's where we were allocated, and we took up positions, mostly guns giving aircraft air defence to 25-pounders. We had a 25-pounder, again, battery with us, and there were one or two guns used for defence of places like Sejnane, which became headquarters. I always remember the first casualty that we had was the battery clerk. He wasn't very well. This was a tale I got. Wasn't well. The hospital, the field hospital, had been set up in Sejnane, so he went because he was perhaps a cold or something, and he just went for treatment. And poor man, they bombed the place whilst he was there, and he lost his leg. And that was his war finished. And off he went back home again. But that was very sad. I mean, fortunately, just, as I say, something like having a cold, and it cost him his leg. And we occupied several sites. This was the practice with light attack. You were allocated, an officer went and decided they'd have a gun here and a gun there and so on. And then you went, you took your gun and your crew, and you dug a hole so you could, you know, set it in defence. And it was always during the night. And it was always very hard to dig because it was rocky. And you'd be there, perhaps, and they'd have one or two rounds to shoot off, because the only aircraft we saw was German. There were British aircraft available, but of course, this was January and February, and it rained. It really did rain. And so the airfields were bogged. The German aircraft seemed to be able to fly, but ours didn't. So that if you saw an aircraft, you didn't ask a question, you fired at it. And, didn't very often hit anything. It was a very chancy thing, I always think. I mean, the Focke-Wulfs and Messerschmitts usually 300 mile an hour, you know, certain. The nearest we got was, I think, was a chap who was obviously he was spotting, as I say, where guns and troops were. And he happened just to get into our sight, so we had a go at him. We didn't hit him, but by Jove, it was close. And as a result of that, unfortunately, we got shelled the next day. He'd seen us. But there we go.
Was did the German Air Force do much damage to the 25-pounders?
No, they didn't really. No, I think the real damage was done by the artillery itself. I mean, the German artillery was much better than ours, bigger. The Germans had tanks. They did actually attack us because we had to retreat. And that caused a bit of a hey-ho by a gun. Because of the weather, it was impossible to get three guns out of the valley in which they'd been sighted because they just got bogged down. So they had to be left. So we retreated. I remember this because it took me all of 4 hours to move the gun. We had to tow it. We had a winch on the lorry, and you could tack your winch, stretch it out, and pull it that way. And that was the only way to get the vehicle to move. In addition, because of the shelling that they'd subjected us to, we didn't know, but one of the tyres had burst. We had to change a wheel, which was a bit hazardous. The vehicle, you see, it was too boggy to get the vehicle too far down this particular field. So the vehicle was stuck near a tree, and that's why we had to use the winch. And we had to use any boards or anything like that in order to get the wheels moving, to get the gun shifted. So I'll say it took us about 4 hours to get the thing onto a bit of a solid road, and then we joined the rest of what was left of the battery further down the road. I never read any more about that, really, but there it was. It was quite a hazard. And at the time we were moving out, we were actually, at that moment, we'd been allocated support for the 5.5s. These are the medium guns, much bigger than the 25s. And as I was driving along with my driver in the vehicle, you know, we saw that the mediums were also pulling out and moving back. And we actually moved right back because the Germans pressed very hard at that point. And we finished up at the end of February at a place that we'll not forget called Jebel Abiod. And we were more or less centred round that and sighted in a ring round this place. That was about the end of February. In March, the rest of the regiment had arrived, the two other brigades, because they were always short of men in Tunisia, you know. I mean, they would have done a lot better from the word go if they'd landed more men anyway on the 8th of November, which was the first landing. But there we are, they stinted on the equipment that they had and the troops that were available. And I think, possibly, they were simply just going to hold it until Montgomery's lot came up from Alamein and up into Tripoli and so on. March, we then had the Americans who were at a place called Kasserine. They'd taken over from the Guards. The Guards were attached to the 78th Division. I remember that because I was sighted with the gun off the road that went from Jebel Abiod to a place called Beja, B-E-J-A. And there was obviously, we were about a quarter of a mile on a track off the main road. But there seemed to be a lot of noise, movement on the road, so I went up to see what was going on. And it was the Guards who were forming up on that road. And I said, well, where are you going? Oh, we're going back to Kasserine because the Americans couldn't hold it. And that was one of those moments in the campaign when the Americans were very green at that point. And so the Guards, who had just come back for a rest, were off again to win back the land that they'd lost. So that was March. And then, and certain attacks were put in round Medjez el Bab And we were associated with those. And in April, things began to gather, because by then Montgomery's men had arrived at Enfidaville, and they were unable to go any further. So it was Alexander who took over, really, and moved troops round onto the First Army side, so that people like the 7th Armoured Division came across, plus an Indian division, plus several others. And eventually, in May, the attack was made down the main road from Majdzabab to Tunis.
Did you take part in that?
We were actually on the south of that particular, our own 139 Brigade, and we were moving in the same direction to a place called Pont du Pas, I think that was the name.